The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Ladies, gentlemen, and cyborgs of all ages, please welcome Dr. Susan Hockfield to the Free Library of Philadelphia.
Thank you, Jason. Thank you, Andy. I'm really thrilled to be part of this storied lecture of stories. It's a wonderful book series, and I'm really, really delighted to be here. So I'm going to share with you my story, the story of my just-released book. Yesterday was publication date, or book birthday, I've been calling it. And I'm going to talk to you about what it presents. It's a story about the future. I'm not a futurist, so it's a real story about the future, I believe. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to give you a little bit of history, technology history. I'm going to describe the probable future, and then I have a few slides recommending how we might really get there. So I did have the amazing privilege of being president of one of the world's greatest technology-based universities. And I can tell you, the perspective from the president's office was absolutely amazing. To gaze across the full spectrum of discovery and innovation and tech transfer really took my breath away. But most importantly, what I saw looking across that frontier was a future that was promising, that was optimistic, and that organized our disciplines in a way that was different from anything I'd understood before. So, I say that, understanding that the future, as we currently see it, will present us with enormous challenges. We currently have somewhere north of 9.5 billion people on the planet. Very sound predictions hold that there will be over 9.7 billion people on the planet by 2050. Our resources that support our already large population will be vastly insufficient to meet the needs of our growing population. So, you know, sounds awful, but the human race has faced this dilemma before. One of my favorite examples is Thomas Malthus, who wrote a treatise about this, he made the astute observation that the rate of growth of the production of food was outpaced by the rate of growth of population. Having observed that at the time, he went back and did a very interesting demographic analysis, and he said, you know what? This has happened before. Population grows faster than food grows, and, you know, it ends in tears. Every period of rapid population growth, he said, ends with war, famine, pestilence, not a very happy scene. And he predicted that that was about to happen. He was writing from his position in Britain. And, you know, he could have been right. But what Malthus did not recognize is there were new agricultural technologies just beginning to be deployed. What were they? Farmers of the day were beginning to use four-field crop rotation, which meant that a given plot of land could be more productive because it could be farmed again and again if you rotated crops through it. Probably more importantly is, you know, we think about the 18th century as a time of exploration, people sailing the seas, finding new lands to find things like gold, interesting things like bananas or potatoes. But the other thing they found along the way were islands that were uninhabited by people, but were inhabited by birds. So these islands were often basically big piles of bird poop, guano, and as anyone who's had a garden knows, that is just great fertilizer. And so what those ships were bringing back, some of them, had a great commerce in fertilizer, in bird poop. That was an incredible boom for the crops in Britain, and counter to Malthus's predictions, the rate of food productivity increased faster than the rate of population growth, but you know how it goes. Population growth also caught up. The message is simple. If we're going to find our way to a future that's better than our present, we have to invent a new set of technologies that will help us deal with our growing population. So I am going to give you a few examples. I'm going to give you a little history, as I said, a few examples of the future that I see. Others are in the book. And a little bit of a recipe to get there. So I'm going to start with some history, which many of you may know. And that's how we got to the future we're living in today. So that was my job as president, to figure out, you know, what's the future going to be? How are we going to get there? My crystal ball is really fuzzy. I figured I'll understand what the futures we're living in today and how we got here, and then it might be easier to map to the next future. So the future we're living in today, one would say the most transformational technologies of the 20th century, I left my phone. Does anyone have a cell phone in the audience? Changed our lives in our lifetime. The digital technologies that we enjoy today come from a convergence of physics with engineering, convergence 1.0, I call it, that was possible because the parts list of the physical world was decoded around 1900. So I'm showing here on the left one of my great heroes, Michael Faraday. And, you know, in mid-19th century, he was doing amazing experiments studying the behavior of electromagnetism, the behavior of electricity. He had no idea what it actually was that he was studying, but he was describing their behavior. Now, one of my themes will constantly be, this was just fundamental research, curiosity-driven research. He had a big following because people found this stuff fascinating, but it wasn't until J.J. Thompson over here discovered the electron in 1897 that people began to have any idea what the forces were behind those electromagnetic forces that Faraday was describing. So not just Thompson, but a whole group of physicists decoded the electron, the proton, the neutron, and subsequently. The electronics industry. There wasn't an electronics industry in 1900, but there became one. Produced our radios, our telephones, our televisions, movies. All kinds of things were possible because of understanding the parts list of physics. That convergence of physics with engineering was rapidly accelerated during World War II. Like all wars, technology wins a war. And the Allies, with the United States playing a very significant leadership role, mustered the forces of the convergence of physics with engineering to build the technologies that won World War II. An amazing technological triumph. So radar, sonar, atomic power and atomic weapons, the list goes on, laid the foundations for the computer technologies of, that came really of age later on. And as the war was coming to an end, FDR asked Vannevar Bush, who had been the leader of this technology effort, whether the lessons learned in the wartime application of science could not be profitably applied to peace. So we've invested massively to build these technologies. Following wars, what happens to nations? They go into depressions. They've overspent their budgets. They've got to tighten their belts. They stop spending. The people who have been fighting on the battlefield come home. There aren't any jobs. It's a mess. So Vannevar Bush and FDR were committed to not letting that happen in the United States, continue these federal investments. And Bush, in response to FDR's request, produced an amazing treatise. It's called Science, the Endless Frontier. It is a blueprint for the second half of the 20th century in America. He talked about the GI Bill. He talked about mortgages for GIs. He talked about community colleges. He talked about federal funding. And he actually said, for any of you in the audience who has competed for federal funding, he said, how are these federal funds going to be spent? We're going to use peer review to distribute those funds. Amazing. So, and more. So that was great. We had a blueprint. But FDR died, and his successors were, let's just say, a little bit less enthusiastic about this idea of continuing to overspend, with the promise Bush understood that this would seed new industries and return enormous economic benefits. In any case, Truman and Eisenhower, less enthusiastic. So we were moving forward on the Bush plan a little bit slowly until some of you may remember that day, October 4th, 1957, when Sputnik crossed the skies of America and every nation around the planet. We decided we need to get a little bit more serious about the Bush plan. And President Kennedy announced the race to the moon in 1961 that we would put a man on the moon and bring him home. In this decade, it happened in about 8 years. And he made many speeches. This is one of my favorites. I just, you know, would love quoting this one that he gave at Rice University. And the point is that we He said, we choose to go to the moon not because it's easy, but because it's hard. And this national ambition, this goal, will serve to organize and measure the best of our energies and skills. And indeed it did. This is the 50th anniversary of Apollo 11, the moon landing, and we are celebrating it. We're not just celebrating the astronauts, we're celebrating all the men and women that participated in this incredible development of technology that made that possible. So Sputnik cast a very dark shadow. People often ask me where I came from and how I got to where I am, and I always say I grew up under the shadow of Sputnik. This is me with my three sisters. I was second. My older sister was very talented in the language arts. I was more talented in science and math. And in second grade, I wrote an expression of the Kennedy ambition that I think is obviously a little embarrassing to show you, but it illustrates a point that I want to make. So this is the essay. Uh-oh, this screen is a really has high resolution. So some of you can actually read my real writing rather than my correction of my writing, and you'll recognize what a terrible speller I was. My handwriting was pretty bad. I was not an artist. Our third sister was the artist. But in any case, this was an essay written in the third person about someone else who was going to be a scientist. I didn't know that I was reading my own autobiography. But the important thing is that scientists, maybe you could figure something else out. Maybe you'll figure out how to go to the moon, but it would be fun. And it calls out for me the marvelous paradox of scientific research. You do something that is enormously fun, enormously rewarding, but also serves the world. So what this marvelous Convergence 1.0 of physics and engineering produced was a host of technologies. I'm not even going to, you know what they are. And it's not just new technologies, enormous economic growth. It was a boon for everything in the United States. So while physics was doing that, what was biology doing? I would say, not much. Biology was descriptive. It had not yet become a predictive science. Biology has had three revolutions that changed it dramatically. The first, molecular biology, was the discovery of some of the components of the biological universe. I'm showing here Jim Watson, Francis Crick, Rosalind Franklin, and Maurice Wilkins, who are very important in describing the structure of DNA. Margaret Chase and Al Hershey had described that DNA was the heritable substance. That's a fascinating story by itself. This was a world that was emerging very rapidly in the 1950s and 1960s. It was a one-by-one analysis of genes. Very important, but frankly, not enormously practical. The Human Genome Project launched the second revolution, which is the revolution in genomics. Rather than doing one-by-one, you can understand genes many by many. What this slide shows is it competes the dropping cost, this is getting a little pale, in the cost of sequencing a genome with Moore's law, and you all know that Moore's law talks about the doubling of the number of transistors on a chip every 2 years, and that's been an astonishing rate of progress, but frankly, the rate of progress as measured by the cost of sequencing a genome is amazing. The first human genome, $100 million, 10 years. Today, less than $1,000, probably half a day, depending on how much detail you want. An incredible kind of progress based on great new technology, also fabulous biological insights. The important point of this is that genomics and molecular biology have given us a parts list of the biological world, just as we had a parts list of the physical world. When I arrived at MIT, the then Dean of Engineering, Tom Magnanti, told me that of the 390 faculty in the School of Engineering, daunting just by itself, he said one-third of the faculty in the School of Engineering are using biological components in their work. That kind of surprised me. And I said, yeah, biomedicine. He said, no, it's well beyond biomedicine. And that began to open up what I have come to understand as the third revolution in biology, which is the convergence of biology with engineering. Biology now has a parts list, and engineers, according to Dean Magnanti, are picking up that parts list and using them to build new things. So I'm going to give you three examples of what this convergence means, and basically it means roughly building things with biological parts rather than physical parts, but it also means using, advanced engineering practice to decode things that are going on in biology. So three examples. I've chosen these examples and the other examples in the book based on what I see as the things we just need, absolutely have to solve in order to get to 2050 with 9.7 billion people without blowing ourselves up by people competing for resources. So the first is an example from medicine. I probably don't need to remind you that our medical expenses are growing dramatically, and we're not doing so good at containing them. So if you want to lower health costs and deliver better health care, probably the first best thing you can do is prevent disease. So vaccines, big in the news, very important. Prevent, prevent, prevent. And frankly, don't do stupid things that might lead you to have cancer. Don't smoke, wear sunscreen, don't inhale asbestos, all these things that we're now doing. And actually, for the first time over the last couple of years, deaths from cancer have actually begun to decrease in the country. So we're having some success. But even if we did all of the preventative things, cancer would still be a problem. So the second best thing, if you can't prevent a disease, or if you don't wear sunscreen when you should, like I don't sometimes, is early detection. Not every disease, but many diseases can be controlled if you detect them early and treat them early. Cancer is a prime example. Cancer starts out as an aberrantly dividing cell that becomes several cells, becomes hundreds of cells, becomes thousands of cells. If you can stop that cancer, if you can detect it when it's only a small group of cells, before it's invaded through the tissue it's in and moved to other tissues, you have a very high probability of a cure. Treating it later is very expensive and, frankly, a very difficult process. So my colleague, Sangeeta Bhatia, has designed a convergence technology that promises earlier and more accurate detection. So I'm going to describe this briefly. I'm happy to come back to any of these issues in the question period afterward. But this is a nanoparticle, this dark turquoise part, that she's decorated with small strings of protein. Now, one of the amazing things about the biological world is every tissue, every cell has its own characteristic proteins. Diseases often have their own characteristic proteins. And one characteristic protein of many diseases is a kind of protein called an enzyme. An enzyme is a molecule that cuts other proteins at very specific sites. Cancer has such an enzyme. And what Sangeeta has done, this is a little cartoon of an enzyme. She has designed these little protein stalks to contain the enzymatic site for a cancer enzyme. So you have this nanoparticle decorated with these stalks. If you don't have cancer, it's fine. It doesn't go anywhere. Nothing happens. But if you do have cancer, the cancer, little cancer enzyme will clip at all of the specific cancer enzyme sites because that's the way she designed it. She calls this a synthetic biomarker. So the little clipped off parts are small, they go into the bloodstream, they circulate around in the bloodstream, but guess what? She has made them so small that when the blood goes through the kidney excretes it as it does with all the contaminants in the blood. And these little particles collect in the urine. And then perhaps you could detect them there. Perhaps you could detect them cheaply. Does anyone know of a kind of cheap, pretty effective, pretty high efficiency urine test? Over-the-counter pregnancy tests. Cheap, easy, non-invasive. So the idea is that you collect these in urine, which in normal conditions have very little protein, so they stand out against the background, unlike blood. And she has designed this so that these enzymes, of course, cut many, many molecules, not just once and done. They will cut thousands of molecules, so there's amplification there. And she has multiplexed these to get a very, very high fidelity, very accurate reading. Right now, she can detect tumors only in mice so far, but she has a company called Glimpse Bio to move this into humans. But she can detect tumors that are one-tenth the size of current detection methods. So colonoscopy, mammography, good, but actually not good enough. This is a very ambitious but also very promising new technology from the convergence of biology with engineering. My next example is from energy. What can I say about energy? It is predicted that we will have twice the energy demand by 2050 than we have today. The population grows, and I would say happily, not only is the population growing, it is growing more prosperous. People are coming out of poverty, and as they come out of poverty, guess what? They'd like to have a refrigerator. They'd like to have a car. They'd like to have air conditioning. They'd like to do all the things that we do that are very energy intensive. So the energy demands are going to be great. well, what's going to be our solution? I mean, you know, maybe we could stay in fossil fuels. I don't personally think that's a very good idea. And, you know, we love the idea of alternative energy technologies. Who doesn't love solar? Who doesn't love wind? Well, we like it when the sun shines and when the wind blows, but that doesn't always happen. So the rate-limiting technology for most alternative energy technologies is energy storage, is batteries. And we're just not that good at batteries. I mean, we have batteries, but does anyone know how batteries are made? Enormous heat, huge energy consumption to build batteries, and a lot of toxic byproducts. This is not an end-to-end sustainable idea, so we need better batteries. Angie Belcher is shown here, another colleague from MIT. She's holding in her hands an abalone shell, and some of you can probably see that it's filled with little coin cell batteries. Those are not normal coin cell batteries. Those are the coin cell batteries that she's made. Actually, she hasn't made them. She's persuaded some viruses to make them. She fell in love with the abalone shell when she was a graduate student at UC Santa Barbara. She walked the shoreline, and she just loved abalone shells, not because of what they look like, but because of what they represent. Abalone is a sea snail. It gathers up components from the ocean in which it lives, and it organizes them into its shell. Very strong, very effective bit of technology. When the abalone dies, the shell disintegrates into its component parts, which are then on offer for the next abalone or the next sea creature to build something else. And Angie thinks, if abalone can build their shells without contaminating their environment, why can't we? Why can't we use nature's genius to do a similar kind of thing? So she has developed a technology that uses a lab strain of virus, M13. It's illustrated at the top over here. So she has, she calls it, rapidly evolved these viruses to do something that we need them to do. What we need them to do is organize components of batteries. So she has succeeded in building batteries, both anodes and cathodes, out of viruses. The batteries that are in these coin cells have the same charge density as state-of-the-art lithium-ion batteries. They can do the same number of charge and recharge cycles as state-of-the-art lithium batteries. But the really fabulous thing about these batteries is she makes them at room temperature in her lab with no toxic byproducts. This would be a huge advance. Now, I told her, I was giving talks a couple weeks ago, and I came back and I was reporting to her something that someone had asked, and she said, oh, guess what? What we're currently working on is batteries that use no lithium and no cobalt. Anyone who's been reading the news about the implications of lithium and cobalt mining and their sufficiency will think that's a really good idea. So Angie is using nature's genius to build the things that we need to provide a sustainable energy future. The next example is water. So the Coleridge poem, water, water, everywhere, ne'er a drop to drink. Most of the water on the face of the earth is not useful for anything that we do. It's salt water. Only 1% of the water is fresh water. Most of that is trapped in ice and in soil. We already have too little fresh water to provide our needs. And frankly, that's been going on for thousands of years. There's a drawing from Egypt in 1500 showing a filtration apparatus that frankly isn't that different from the filtration apparatus that we use today. So filtration, distillation, not enough, and an inefficient technology. So this is, to my mind, an amazing story. Peter Agre, a physician scientist at Johns Hopkins University, wanted to understand a protein called the Rh protein. Many of you will have heard of it because it used to be a big problem. When a mother's Rh protein didn't match her fetus's, the mother's antibodies could really damage the fetus and sometimes kill it. Well, we figured out how to mitigate that problem, so that's not a problem today, but we didn't for a long time know what the Rh protein was, and Peter Agre said, I'm going to study that. I'm a hematologist. That seems like a good problem. So he dove in, got a lot of red blood cells, purified them, you know, went through this elaborate purification step, ended up with a band on a gel. He made antibodies to the band on the gel and discovered it wasn't the Rh protein. It was something else. He didn't know what it was. So he went back and purified it again, same result. So he faced a dilemma that all scientists face. You're after something, that's something you don't get. What do? You go back and try again. You don't go off on a, you know, wild goose chase, you know, looking for something that, you know, you have no idea what it is, but for some reason, he could not get his mind off this new protein. And a colleague of his, in looking at the results, said, huh, that might be the water channel. Well, the water channel, a channel in our cells that allows water to move in and out, had been sought for decades, and no one had found it. And everyone agreed that water got into and out of cells by diffusion across the membrane. So he has an unknown protein. His colleague says maybe it's the water channel, and he says, but the water channel doesn't exist. So then he crazily said, okay, I'll find out, and spent the rest of his career working on what really was the water channel. So he purified this protein, and this part of the slide, this is the cell membrane, and this is a picture, a cross-section of a water channel that sits in the cell membrane. It is a fascinating structure. It's a complicated protein, but it does a beautiful job of purifying water. Only water goes through most variants of aquaporin, which is what he called it. Some pass other things, but there are many variants that are just water-specific. Amazing set of studies. He'd studied the biophysics, the structure, and great science. Again, fundamental kind of curiosity-driven science. But he published the paper, and a biophysicist in Illinois, a biophysicist entrepreneur, this amazes me, this leap, read the paper and said, wow, that is so cool. Maybe we could use it for a water filter. And I visited him recently. He has a company called Aquaporin AS. It's outside Copenhagen. And guess what? They're building water filters using aquaporin. So this is a small vesicle that has several aquaporin channels in it. These vesicles, now here shown as circles, sit on a membrane to support them because they're not that strong, and they can filter water. And these water filters are now in homes in Asia, purifying water for drinking and other use. The company is determined to build commercial quality water filters, commercial scale water filters, and they are on their way to changing the game, changing the way we think about water purification. Another phenomenal example of using biological parts to solve technological problems. So, I've mentioned before the challenges of the 21st century. We've got to solve these problems so that these 9.7 billion people are not going to be fighting one another over our diminishing resources. So how do we do this? How do we accomplish this? We know the path very well. Robert Solow, who won a Nobel Prize in economics, observed for this particular observation that the economic growth in the United States after World War II, 50% of it is attributable to technology. An astonishing discovery in economics. But what that means is we have got to work to build our technological base in order to grow our economy. So that's great, and we have funded federally supported research because no company can really afford to do it because you never know what's going to work, and most of it doesn't work. But it does provide the seed corn for further technological advance. Now, fundamental research is always, let's just say, suspect, always debated. And one example I will give is what has been reported. I don't know if it really is true. I haven't been able to really determine that it's true. This is our friend Michael Faraday again, who is busy doing his marvelous experiments on electromagnetism. And William Gladstone, who was essentially Secretary of the Treasury in Britain, said to him, why are you doing this? What is it good for? And Faraday is reported to have replied, why, sir? There's every I don't know what it's going to be good for, but there's every probability that you will soon tax it. And again, we certainly have. So basic research is enormously inefficient. I just told you the inefficient story of Peter Agre, but it is our only known route to discovery. We have to fund that to make it work. So if we think about how the United States has actually participated in this funding of the seed corn for our technology development, this shows a graph of our federally funded research starting from about 1953, close to today. And we reached our peak in federal investments in research in the mid-1960s. Since then, it has tailed off. And now it was about 2% of GDP in the mid-60s. We're now down at 0.7, 0.8% of GDP. Still a lot of money, but not as much of a national commitment as we made in the past. I've also shown here that business has amped up what it's spending on research. But remember, this is research and development. And what business is funding is mostly the development phase and not the fundamental research phase. So I find this extremely concerning. I find it even more concerning in view of the next slide. So this shows the commitment by other governments. You have to remember that following World War II, the United States was the only game in town. We were the only nation sufficiently developed to have a research enterprise, and all of our possible competitors were using all of their resources to rebuild their countries after the war. No longer true. So you can see that there are a number of countries that invest more of their GDP than we do. But the line that I would say really sobers me is this purple line, which represents China's investments. I don't know whether it will be last month or next month or next year, China will surpass us in their commitment to funding basic research. And they are committed to building an innovation economy just like ours. And, you know, I love competition. I just want to play to win. So we have to think very seriously about how we're using our resources to build our future. So I think there are a couple things we can do in terms of federal funding. The first, federal policy. The first is sustained funding, not rather than having funding that goes way up and way down, having a commitment over a very long period of time. This convergence business that I've talked about sounds easy. Oh, put some biologists and engineers together. That's just great. It's insufficient. It's insufficient for a number of reasons. A big reason why it's very hard to get off the ground is that our funding agencies have been fantastic, but they are discipline-based. The National Institutes of Health funds biology and biomedicine. Department of Energy funds physics and computation. The National Science Foundation funds engineering and computation and mathematics. And I can tell you, it is really hard to get a grant for projects that cross those disciplines. Occasionally we get it together, the National Nanotechnology Initiative, the Human Genome Project, the New Brain Initiative. All of those are kind of one-off cross-agency initiatives, but we don't do it regularly. Another very important piece is policies that support investment in innovation. You know, our tax incentives for investing in innovation privilege what is called long-term investments, but those investments are no more than 2 years. The kind of technologies I'm talking about and that we've already seen coming out of this convergence, and frankly out of biology even, are tough tech. They take a long time and a lot of money. Going from the HER2 gene to Herceptin, a lifesaver for women with a certain kind of cancer, 20 years and $1 billion or so. So we need longer term investments and we need incentives for those kinds of investments. Sitting at MIT, I saw a lot of commerce between the academy and industry. I think MIT could do more. I think we all could do more in terms of building the kinds of partnerships that transfer the research products into development. So I am optimistic that the products of Convergence 2.0, products of the convergence of biology with engineering, offer the possibility of our finding solutions to the really big dilemmas of the 21st century. I would love it if we had a national ambition. I grew up not under the shadow of Sputnik, but under the bright beacon of the national ambition to go to the moon and come back. And I think that what I've seen in my roles in leadership, that a shared ambition is one of the most powerful motivators for people to work together and do things that they could never have done on its own. So I have a book, which is why I'm here, that describes these technologies and more. And let me just say that these technologies may sound like science fiction. They're not. All of those that I've described are ready to, you know, get out of the lab and go to the marketplace. I wrote the book for a general audience. A colleague of mine, a very, very enormously successful and very brilliant businesswoman, I told her about the book. She said, wow, that sounds interesting. Will I learn what a gene is? I just made my face go flat. I did not laugh at her. I did not make that face of like, what do you mean? You don't know. Anyway, but she became my guard star as I wrote this book. I want the book to explain to people who want to know what a gene is, but really haven't walked that walk to discover it. So I think my effort has been to describe these fairly complicated technologies in terms that everyone can understand so that we can all feel like we're part of a national ambition to solve the problems of the 21st century. Thank you very much. So, questions on any topic? Yes, back there?
How do you think we can do, you know, I mean, what can the government do, what can universities do to kind of bridge that gap between the research and development and scaling that up here in the United States? We can create jobs and we can keep that cycle going.
Yeah. So your point is very well taken, and I agree with you 1,000%. And one of my points is privileging investments for long cycle capital intensive industries, because, you know, if we privilege investments, I don't do social media, but you know, you can make your money in 18 months or 6 months. And so the rush to fund shorter term investments that pay off faster is draining the resources that we need for longer term investments. Let me just talk about a term you used, which is scale up. So there was a study done at MIT, and MIT, let's just say, is pretty good at tech transfer. MIT and Stanford are generally held out as the, you know, the leaders. So we did a study to look at what happens to technology as it leaves campus. Startup works pretty well. Small money, short time. Scale up is the killer. And so we need different kinds of structures to fund scale up. In the old days, so my colleagues at MIT who told me the stories about back in the day, banks. I mean, so the sources of funding were not just venture capital, they were other sources of funding. And I think we need to develop incentives for people to invest. There's another point that I'm sorry to go on too long, but I'm just very, very committed to government-industry partnerships. So I co-chaired the Advanced Manufacturing Partnership with Andrew Liveris. And what we started, and some of them still exist, are basically big incubators, regional incubators, to do things for the next level of manufacturing. So there is a 3D printing center, there is a photonics center in different parts of the nation that draw on the region's talents, but also serve as a nidus for the development of economic development. I think this kind of thing is really great, and I'm sure that if we go back to Science the Endless Frontier, Vannevar Bush would have already proposed them. So I hope that kind of thing will happen, and you know, this is our political situation will require that kind of commitment.
Thank you for a great talk. The question I have is, you know, we're coming to a point, of, like you're bringing out in your book, of convergence of biology and technology. And one of the things, obviously, that's in the news these days is CRISPR. Very interesting technology, but at times it's very obvious that we don't catch up as people to put guards up against what could be a very dangerous technology. I wonder what's being done about maintaining standards of not having germline type of CRISPR things that could potentially change who we are as people moving forward right now, or is it something that's being experimented with actively?
Yeah, so a very timely and very appropriate question about the dangers of technology. But I always have to remind myself and others that technology is agnostic, it's how it's used. And we have faced times in the past where we had a technology that was potentially dangerous. And as a society, not just the scientists and engineers on their own, but together with bioethicists and others, have set up guardrails that says no one operates outside of these guardrails. Frankly, when gene engineering was first introduced, everyone was very, very concerned about the possible negative effects of it. And you know, in Cambridge, where I now live, there was an opportunity to have a new biotech company, and the city of Cambridge wouldn't permit it, but it forced a hearing that made Cambridge one of the first cities in the country to establish regulations, and that allowed the biotechnology companies to begin in Cambridge, and San Francisco did the same. And so we need that kind of shared understanding of what limits we need to set now, with also the realization that those boundaries are going to change as we learn more. Sounds great. However, my concern about this, I'm only going to make you more scared about this, that kind of shared governance requires shared governance. And in an age in the 50s and 60s and even 70s, when the United States was almost alone in these frontiers, perhaps with some Western European countries, those principles could be enforced and policed. So right now, I'm extremely concerned about standards of scientific conduct in other countries, and this CRISPR twin set only, I think, illustrates the reason for my fear. And I should also tell you, just to be clear, I think while we have to understand that CRISPR can be used to engineer humans, my greatest fear is CRISPR-engineered pathogens, which are easier and harder to detect. And so we will need to develop regulatory structures that allow us to stop that kind, nip that kind of thing in the bud. But it's hard, and this is just, you know, it's like cybersecurity. I mean, you know, but we have to step up, recognize that it's a problem, and do what needs to be done to control it as best we can.
We were using artificial limbs during the Civil War. Now we're going on close to 200 years. Is there anything in the offering to grow back limbs biologically rather than with metal appliances? I mean, isn't it about time we had a breakthrough on that line? I mean, starfish do it, why can't we?
Yeah, so I have a number of colleagues who are working on this, working on tissue regeneration, limb regeneration. We are, I would say, I'm sorry to report, we're not very near that. So I have nothing to offer in terms of promise for understanding the mechanism of axolotl limb regeneration and transferring it to humans. But I think the biological sophistication is getting to the point where I hope we will have some insight. However, one of the chapters in the book is about bionics and about the new generation of artificial limbs that provide a much, much better, more agile experience and really do feel and operate. They're brain-driven, so they operate the way your limb would. Not perfect, but they're at least first out prosthetics that offer the possibility of normal walking, mountain climbing, with a real sense of where your foot is, not just a prop to stand on. The other part of that chapter deals with reading brain signals to allow people who are paralyzed from spinal cord injury or stroke. There was a recent report just, I think, last week about reading out the patterns of speech and giving people synthetic speech just by reading brain and muscle patterns. So I think this is enabled by incredible computational ability. So I didn't talk about computation. That's going to continue, but other people are covering that, so I'm focusing on something else. But I think there's a lot of possibility around enabling the disabled with these new technologies, not regrowing limbs yet.
Thanks for the talk. You mentioned economies of war being a springboard for economic growth, and as much as the fact that what we spend here on military gives me heartburn, is this a springboard of what can be seen as a product of that GDP investment in technology with the amount of money that we spend in that and the use of that money for these types of solutions? Because I'm sure the military is working on all of these technologies that regrow limbs and does a whole bunch of other things, right?
So there's a tremendous amount of defense investment in new technologies. Historically, DARPA, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Academy, or whatever, has been an enormous contributor to fundamental science. So, and a lot of military technologies do find their way into use. Among my responsibilities as president of MIT was to oversee the Lincoln Laboratory, which is a defense research activity. And while I'm not allowed to tell you what goes on there, because it's in the classified domain, suffice it to say that our exploration of space, the technologies that allow us to, you know, go places we've never gone before, are largely products of defense funding. That's great. And you're right, the Defense Department is funding a lot of robotics and prosthetic research and a number of other things. But it's not as focused, it's not as broad scale, and the fundamental research is not their primary idea. The primary idea is to translate research into not just weapons of war, but also weapons to improve our technologies that will improve our lives. So my fear is, or my hope, I would say, is that the enormously expanded investments in technology during war have proved to be, you know, what makes the difference between who wins and who loses. But, and there are great technology bursts during wars. But my own hope, and it's the last line in the book, that the next technology revolution will be spurred by the promise of peace and not the threat of war. And I don't want to become too political about it, but the Grand Alliance that seems to be falling apart before our eyes would offer, I would say, the kind of power to drive technologies for peace. So I can tell you, drought will provoke war. It has provoked war. Insufficiency of food will provoke war. And it's not necessarily going to provoke war in the United States, but it's going to provoke war in unstable parts of the world. And we know that those instabilities can become contagious. And so I see this very much in the nation's interest to provide the technologies that keep people at peace.
Thanks for your lecture. I have two notes and related questions. One is, I work in an environmental agency, and so I was very aware of the work, the impact done by Dr. Mark Edwards at Virginia Tech when he, you know, shone the light of the lead issue in drinking water in Flint. And when he gave an interview to the Chronicle of Higher Education in 2016, he highlighted this major concern of the peer review process in our academia and the funding process and how it's an incestuous relationship. And if public funding of basic science will not help American citizens, then they will lose faith in it and they won't want science to be funded. And all this other, you know, architecture based on that foundation will be just a dream, not come true. So I want your opinion on that. And secondly...
Well, don't give me the second question because I'll forget the first. Okay. So peer review isn't perfect, but it's the best system we have rather than the genius king who's going to make decisions. However, I've served on peer review panels, and it's a very interesting experience in human dynamic. So, you're sitting around a table with 15 people. Everyone gets to have a vote on every grant. And, you know, there are some ideas that everyone can agree are good ideas. When I have sent grants in myself that were for things I really wanted to do because they weren't yet known, guess what happens when something's not yet known and you get to 15 people? 5 people think it's a good idea, the other 10 think it's a bad idea. Of course, that's why you want to do the experiment, right? And so peer review is not that good at funding the future, the distant future. However, when the funding levels are, let's just say, at 20% of approved grants, you get those grants that have unanimous approval. That's the top 5%. And then the next 15% are those that maybe might work, maybe not. And so the danger we now have is the funding levels are so low that it drives greater conservatism in writing grants and far greater conservatism in awarding grants. You touched on something else, or maybe you didn't. Maybe I just wanted to hear you touch on this because it's something that really terrifies me. All of the things I've talked about, all the principles of organizing our civilization and our society, rest on the idea that there are facts and that science pursues truth as closely as we can today. It's not perfect and it's always evolving. But in a current environment where facts, your facts, my facts, what's a fact? This erodes confidence in science. And I would say even more importantly, the idea that kind of one strike you're out, I can't tell you, I've talked to many people about climate change and global warming. And you know, the science on that is as firm as the science behind your cell phone. And you know, sometimes your cell phone goes wacky. But, you know, frankly, it's the same kind of science. It's not perfect. It's the best we have right now. I think it's sufficiently dire that we should be doing something about it, and I think we can do something about it. And I think doing something about it could be economically enormously rewarding. So I think the whole idea that we should just deny it is just plain foolish. However, in a one-strike-you're-out world where I can't, that there's some little chink in the armor will disprove the whole thing, and this is what people use to discredit entire bodies of work. It's a very, very dangerous time for science, and frankly, because it's a dangerous time for science, I think it's a dangerous time for our future.
You think cooperating with other nations would accelerate the process to make these technologies work versus the United States and the other countries competing for possibly the same things?
Well, that's a very interesting, so competition versus collaboration. You know, we do both. And we figure out how to make advances. And, you know, sometimes we all know the joy of competition and the joy of collaboration. We do collaborate with other nations on most of these advanced technologies. You know, one of the things, when I was first named dean at Yale, the first assignment was to be on a panel about internationalization. And I was so confused. So why are we talking about this? The neuroscience I was doing in New Haven was no different from the neuroscience that was being done in Cologne or London or Zurich. So because science has a single language, certainly for this fundamental research, it is a collaborative, cooperative thing around the world, and no one cares where you are. They just care what your idea is.
I have a quick question about climate change. I was just at another talk, and they said at the end that it's mostly on politicians to do something, because individuals can only do so much. And I was wondering, because politics is so unstable and unpredictable, we can't just rely on them to fix this global issue, right? So do you think biology and technology will combine and try and bring about solutions that could help us solve that problem?
I actually do think that science and technology is a huge amount to contribute. So if we think it's impossible to build a better battery, why would you rush to using more solar or more wind? One of the things that just delighted me when we launched the Energy Initiative at MIT, there were 24 new battery technologies under development. Some of them are going to make it, some aren't. But I think the problem of imagining that it's an impossible climb and we're never going to get there is just another defeatist, you know, part of the defeatist song. And so I think getting technologies that have real promise, getting them funded, is absolutely critical. So it shows people there's a possibility of getting to where you want, where you need to go, rather than just throwing up your hands in defeat. Let me mention something else. So I've emphasized our federal commitment to funding basic research, fundamental research. I have to confess that I did not understand the importance of philanthropy before I was dean, provost, president. So for all of our new initiatives at MIT, these things that are out there that are doing impossible things, like putting biologists and engineers together to advance, to make cancer cures faster. And I describe why it's impossible because of federal funding. We were able to do all that because individuals stepped up and said, we're with you, we're going to fund that too. And it is the, I would say, probably underappreciated catalyst of so much of the really breakthrough technology, and it's true in terms of companies. And so you see people with great resources putting them to work to bring a new technology to market. It's one thing to have, I don't want to, discount it by saying a science experiment, but a lot of the things we have in the lab are science experiments, and to turn those science experiments into real ways of diagnosing cancer or real cures for cancer, that is a heavy lift. And so, the venture community has its own, patterns of funding and passions for funding, but angel investors invest separately. And so I have to say, I've been so impressed by the independence of mind of so many people who really want to help this change happen faster. And so I think by demonstrating change, it's one way we can actually accelerate the kind of change that people resist. We can demonstrate that A, we can do it, B, you can make money at it, C, our lives are going to be better. I think that increases the enthusiasm for it, rather than the defeatist view is that we're never going to do it, so why should we start? Thank you all very, very much for your attention.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.